You've got your Bibles open, right? They should be handy. They should be in your laps. We are in the book of Luke. We will be in chapter 9, and we'll be starting to read right around verse 51. Now, most of our Bibles, they chop these little sections up, but verse 51 is absolutely crucial in the flow of the book of Luke. There are some, in the original language, there's some little indicators that are there that tell us that this is a major shift in the story. And so it plays out like this. When the days drew near for him to be taken up, speaking of Jesus, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. And he sent messengers ahead of him who went and entered a village of the Samaritans to make preparations for him. The Samaritans are just simply for right now, they're just a people group that existed in the Holy Land. But the people, the Samaritans, did not receive him because his face was set toward Jerusalem. And his disciples, James and John, saw it and they said, "Lord, do you want us to tell fire to come down from heaven and consume them?" Wow. There's a couple of guys you want, you know, to just, those are the sons of thunder, by the way. Jesus turns to them and he rebuked them. And they went on to the next village. Thank the Lord. What do we learn from some of these stories? I'm going to give us kind of a little bit of an overview, and then I will dive in just a little bit deeper. Faithful disciples follow the way. That's what the way is, what following Jesus Christ was originally called. In the book of Acts, they call it the way a couple of times. That this is what it meant to walk with Jesus. I kind of like that word picture, though. There's a way, and it's the way of Christ. Sometimes we just talk about all you have to do is believe in Jesus. And while that is true, that belief in Jesus is to change us and transform us, and it puts us following in the footsteps, literally following the steps of Jesus, which means we are following in his way. We're following the way of Christ. That even when facing wickedness, And we're going to see the wickedness that they are facing from a couple of different places here. Even when facing wickedness, a faithful disciple continues to follow the way. Why would I say facing wickedness? I want to remind you of some verses that came just a little bit before in the story. "Behold, two men were talking with Jesus. Moses and Elijah appeared in glory and spoke of what? His departure," which literally is the word his Exodus. In other words, God's taking of Jesus through all kinds of insanity, parting of the Red Sea and all that kind of stuff, to a place that God has promised, which was not particularly good news for Jesus, but it was great news for you and I. That's why we call it the gospel, the good news. He was about to accomplish these things at Jerusalem. Jesus later says, when his popularity is booming, "Let these words sink into your ears. The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men." The disciples said they were fearful. They didn't understand what he was saying. They had no comprehension of what he was talking about. And they were a little bit fearful to ask him about it because it was so outside of anything that they were anticipating. What do these passages teach us about what Jesus is doing? Because the passage literally says that he is turning and setting his face now toward Jerusalem. He's been told by Moses and Elijah up on the mountain, probably on Mount Hermon, that he is going to go through this exodus of sorts, this traveling of sorts, where he will meet certain destruction. He turns to his disciples in the midst of his popularity and he says, "Look, guys, the popularity that you see me experiencing right now, that's not what I'm about. What I'm really, truly about is going to Jerusalem, where I will be turned over into the hands of people that are hostile towards me." Faithful disciples are consumed by Jesus in the face of the deadliest of circumstances. Faithful disciples are consumed by Jesus. Why would I use that kind of a word? It's because of what it says in the text, that as the time drew near, as Jesus turned his face and set it toward Jerusalem. The word literally means it's like a cup that the time had filled up the cup so much that the cup was beginning to overflow. In other words, the time for Jesus had been completely fulfilled. All that he had done up in the north, that was all filled up, and it was now time for Jesus to turn and drink of the cup that had been prepared for him that he was headed toward. Following Jesus means drinking from the full cup that he provides, setting our hearts also on the cross. As Jesus turns to the cross and as he faces the inevitability of his sacrifice, we also, as his disciples, turn towards Jerusalem or toward where he will die, toward that cross, and we set our faces toward it. Consuming Christ, drinking from his cup, also provides us with nourishment, and it literally consumes all of who we are. It becomes the whole of our being as well, and it's a good thing to be mindful of as we are going to observe communion this morning. As we think of consuming the cup of Christ and eating the body of Christ, literally drawing nourishment from who he is for what he has done. We are now called into that same cup. We are now called into that same setting our minds, our hearts, our whole being on the cross of Jesus Christ. We set our eyes onto it and we don't let go of it. Why? Because it sustains us through anything that we need to face. It did the same thing for Jesus. He set his eyes on what God had called him to, and it allowed him to overcome the wickedness and the oppression and the opposition that he was facing. How much do the disciples understand of this? Zero. Nothing. They don't get it at all. And it's illustrated almost immediately, isn't it? We go forward in the text, and it says, James and John come up on a village of the Samaritans. Now, let me just pause here real quick. Can I do that? We have got a fantastic growth group this week. Not that every week isn't fantastic, but this week we are talking about racism, something that is an absolutely crucial issue for us to discuss in the world that we live in. And Luke Schaub, one of our elders, has prepared just a phenomenal growth group guide for us to be able to have some great discussion about racism. Why would we bring that up? It's because of the Samaritans. The Samaritans were half-breeds. They were half Jewish and half something else. And they lived in the middle of the Holy Land. They lived below the region of Galilee and above the city of Jerusalem. And they lived right there in the middle. And the Jews hated the Samaritans so much. They hated them so much that they would walk around the region that they lived in, because they believed that getting the dust of Samaria on their feet made them unclean. That was how much they hated the half-breeds. They would do anything that they could do to marginalize them. And in the midst of that, the Samaritans, knowing the total rejection that they were experiencing amongst the Jews, kind of set up their own way of following God. They set up their own mountain that they felt like God had come to, like Sinai for Moses in the Old Testament. They set up a place called Mount Gerizim. And in the midst of their belief and their following, they would sacrifice there, not in the temple in Jerusalem. They rejected the Jews because the Jews had rejected them, and there was a deep divide that existed between the two. Much like in our own country, where our own history has set certain people at a lower level simply because of the color of their skin, the Jews set the Samaritans on a lower level because they did not come from the pure lineage of Judaism. Now, that might seem horrible to you. But let's face it, we continue to live in a world, even in Southern California, we continue to live in a world that is deeply, deeply affected by racism. We're going to explore that in our growth group a little bit this week. We're not probably going to solve all the issues, but we will be able to kind of raise some of these things up and see where it is that God is at work in our hearts, in a culture and in a world that is desperate for doing what God spoke to us to do, right? I'll never forget, actually, I was at a conference and I was thinking to myself, why do I need to apologize for the sins of, you know, racists that existed 150 years ago and were, you know, white? Like, why would I be responsible for that? And the preacher that was leading the conference opened up the Bible to the book of 1 Corinthians, and he showed us a passage that said that Jesus Christ came and reconciled sinful people, which he bore no responsibility for, by the way. Remember that? Like, Jesus Christ comes, and he bears no actual moral responsibility to solve your and my sin problem. And he says that Jesus Christ holds on to the hand of man and holds on to the greatness of God, and he reconciles, or he pulls them together so that they might have relationship with one another. And then the next verse says that we, as followers of Christ, are also called to be reconcilers, holding the hands of people, even if you don't bear responsibility for what they've done. Even though you don't bear responsibility for their sin, for their issues, for the stuff they've got going on, and hold on to the hand of God, and because Jesus has done this with you, to pull together those two and show them how to have a relationship with each other. And I mean, it was like a light bulb went on in my head. Hey! That's like historically apologizing and taking responsibility for something that isn't my doing, but I, by just virtue of being a human being, have participated in, and I can make a difference in reconciling back together under the lordship of Jesus Christ. You and I are called to these things. So it's very easy, I think, in Southern California, where we live in a very, very diverse area that is very metropolitan, and we would like to, I believe, trust that we are raising our children in the most colorblind society that has ever existed. However, even in the midst of that, there are generation upon generation of racial issues that exist that put some people on one side of the tracks or the traffic circle and then others on the other. And we should explore these things, because even though you may not, it may offend you even right now. I might be offending you that you might bear any responsibility for this. That's not my point. My point is that we are reconcilers. It's what we do. It's who we are. It's in our DNA. And if you don't believe it, boy, read those verses. What is that? 2 Corinthians 5? 1 Corinthians 5? I should probably know that. I'm a pastor and all, but think the disciples understood that reconciliation thing? Well, clearly, look at what they did. James and John, two Jesus' disciples, see the Samaritans, the half-breeds, and they decide, oh, this rejection that they've expressed against Jesus is pretty serious. We're going to call down fire from heaven. Now, you know, just a few verses earlier, they couldn't even cast out a demon. So it's not like they could actually do this. I think it was just, I mean, to be honest, it seems like a little bit of bravado coming from these guys, because they let's face it, their track record is spotty at best up to this point. And so they turn to Jesus and they're like ready to go to fight, you know, hey, just show me who, I'm going to beat them up. And Jesus turns and rebukes them. And it just, the rebuke is direct, immediate. And then it says that he just goes on to the next town. The purpose of Jesus' heart, though, is what leads them into a place. It's that Jesus has his face set toward Jerusalem. In other words, they go to the Samaritan village and they ask him, well, yeah, we would be willing to host you. Where are you headed? And what do they say? Well, we're going to Jerusalem. Our rabbi has his face set to go to Jerusalem. Oh. We want nothing to do with Jerusalem. We want nothing to do with the Jews. We want nothing. No, you may not stay here. James and John miss the significance of what Jesus Christ is communicating to them by turning and setting his face towards Jerusalem and saying, that's the direction we are going. But I want to note a couple of things. One, is Jesus avoiding going around Samaria? He's not, obviously. He's willing to walk where others do not. And two, I think this speaks to the disciples as to what it means to faithfully follow Jesus. First, faithful disciples follow the way even in the face of personal rejection. I don't think James and John appreciated the Samaritan rejection very much. It does seem like they're ready to get serious about taking out the Samaritans at this place. Their attitudes, even their racial attitudes, even the things that they assumed were good and the things they assumed were bad, needed to be subject to their followership of Jesus Christ. This is the only passage, by the way, in the Gospels where the Samaritans are painted in a negative light. And they're painted in a negative light because Jesus has set his face toward Jerusalem. It's not as much a rejection of Jesus as a rejection of all that he represents. And James and John, just right, they miss this entirely. Despite the fact that Jesus has chosen to walk through the middle of Samaria in order to get down to Jerusalem, as he makes his way there, they will face this kind of personal rejection. And he's indicating to his disciples, this is what it's going to be like. This is what it means to actually follow me. Faithful disciples in positions of power intentionally respond to rejection peacefully. I wish every Christian would post this on their Facebook page. Faithful disciples in positions of power, and you may not feel like your social media is a powerful position, but people are listening to the voice of Jesus through the things that you do and say, through the things that you interact with, through the way that you present Christ to the world that is around you. From that position of power, do we respond to rejection peacefully? Do we respond to rejection peacefully in the world that we live in? We are obsessed with standing up for our rights. Jesus does not seem to feel that same need to stand up for his rights as much as we are compelled to. I'm not so much wanting to pick apart us wanting to stand up for our rights as much as I am wanting to point out that the way of Jesus is to sacrifice a position of power and choose intentional peace. Could Jesus have called down fire from heaven? Yes, he could have. And he rebukes two guys that probably couldn't have done that, but maybe were, you know, just passive-aggressively sharing a good idea that they thought of with him and expecting something from him. And his His response is to, no, that's not the way. That's not what we do. We're not call down fire from heaven people. That's not who we are. We're here for different purposes. We will choose peace over violence. We will choose peace over those positions of power intentionally in order to show people how God has peace with them and how God seeks peace with them. Faithful followers or faithful disciples follow the way by choosing weakness over those displays of power. Jesus intentionally moves his disciples on to the next village. He intentionally puts them into a position of weakness. He rebukes them from any kind of display of power and says, no, 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 we choose weakness. In fact, so much so, put your tail between your legs. Here we go. We're out. It must have felt a little bit like a walk of shame, a place where the decisions that they had made, the things that they had said, almost felt like, oh, man, we're really missing it here. I mean, we thought Jesus wanted us to do this, and he turns out totally opposite things going on. You ever been there? You ever thought God was calling you this way, and you just got smacked backwards? Are you living a life that maybe is choosing your own way? You've chosen to take the wheel of your own life, put yourself in a position of power rather than a position of weakness. Each one of us have choices that we make that measure this every day. If you're a student, it's measured by the way you respond to a teacher or a school administrator, a coach. If you are a parent, it's the way that you wield your power in your home. Husbands and wives, the ways that we treat one another. In our community, it's the way that we interact politically, locally, and globally. In the midst of our lives, there are 1,000 ways that this is measured. Do you believe that choosing the way of weakness is the greatest way to display the gospel, the good news, the great news of setting our hearts onto the cross of Jesus Christ? If we are not convinced of this, that there is more to the gospel than just simply belief in our brains and a trust in Jesus instead of a trust of other things, that it actually gets into the midst of our lives, and that the way that we communicate it is by specifically choosing to live the way that Jesus did, that we actually embody that in a reconciliatory way for the world that is around us. If we do not become convinced of that, what it does is it proves that our belief is just like these disciples. It's a belief in intention, but not an actual belief in reality. And Jesus really wants to make clear that this is not who his people truly are. That the gospel is expressed through people that purposely choose weakness for the sake of the gospel. Look what it says in 1 Peter. Peter. Let's not forget who wrote it, right? A guy that couldn't swing a sword straight, a guy that always was good for a fight, a guy that ran his mouth like a crazy man. Peter. For this is a gracious thing, he says, when you are mindful of God and you endure sorrow while suffering unjustly. Students, are you suffering unjustly in your classroom? You share in the sufferings of Christ. Well done. Husband, are you suffering unjustly because of the demands of your wife? Amen. Or just stupidity? You are sharing the sufferings of Christ. Wives, please don't yell at. Wives, are you suffering unjustly under the leadership of a husband? But perhaps many of you have come to me, a husband that doesn't even know Christ. Are you connected to families, people that do not know Christ? Are you suffering for these things? Are you in a position of suffering unjustly? I want you to take that suffering that you're experiencing and not see it as being, woe is me, why am I in this position? This is violating my rights, and move it to a place of an experience of Christ that is intimate and that you are sharing with Him and that you are bearing as the very wounds that He bore, that you share in the midst of every suffering in the suffering of Jesus Christ. Peter goes on, what credit is it if when you sin, you are beaten for it? In other words, if you sin and you get spanked, so to speak, that's not really all that remarkable, is it? That's what's happened to you ever since you were a child. So what if you endure that? If you're bad, you're going to pay the price. That's normative. But if when you do good and suffer for it and you endure, this is a gracious thing. It is an experience of grace in the sight of God. Oh, we just had to keep reading, didn't we? For to this you have been called. Not to avoid it, but when you find it, to embrace it. You've been called to it. Because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you might follow in His steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in His mouth. When He was reviled, He did not revile in return. When He suffered, He did not threaten, but He continued to entrust Himself to Him who judges justly. He kept His eye on Jerusalem. He kept His eye on the cross. He never lost sight of His purpose. Have you? Faithful disciples intentionally choose weakness, not because we are trying to be martyrs, not because we are trying to, oh, look at us, constantly taking positions of weakness. No, it's for the sake of God's power to be revealed. It says that God chose the weak things of this world in order to display the greatness of God. And because of this, faithful disciples choose paths of perseverance over the paths of least resistance. We walk through Samaria. It's what we do. We do not pull into our hermetically sealed homes and open up our hermetically sealed garages and pull in our hermetically sealed cars and then walk to where we don't have to see any neighbors into our houses, and then we stay there until we have to go to work again, and then we come out and we get in our little cars and we go out and we meet neighbors that have lived next to us for years, and we see them, you know, maybe meaningfully twice in the whole year. We purposely walk through Samaria. We purposely put ourselves into positions where we are engaging the world that absolutely needs God that is all around us. That world could be in your bedroom. And that world could be in the uttermost parts of the earth. But you and I are called to follow in His steps. Jesus, when He understood that the cup that He was about to drink was full, turned His eyes and locked them onto Jerusalem and all that it meant. You and I, knowing what that sacrifice means, are called to this table this morning to walk in His steps, to do so in remembrance of Him, to consume the body and the blood and to be consumed and nourished and overwhelmed by it. What is Jesus calling you to give up for the sake of the gospel, to make weak so that he can be strong?